Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge, and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital. And I'm joined by Lyndon Robison, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. It's good to be with you. And hello, everyone.
Lyndon and I share a passion for the concept of social capital, and we each have a long history of work on the concept. However, we have very different perspectives because Lyndon is from economics and my background is in sociology and social theory. And our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting and engaging conversations and debate. So in this episode, we're going to discuss the topic of whether social capital is everything and everywhere. Lyndon, as a starting point, do you think that social capital has become too ubiquitous to be useful as a concept?
If it hasn't become too ubiquitous, it's surely knocking on the door, because there are so many definitions of social capital, many of which are not even definitions, that the concept is really in need of clarifying what it means, maybe limiting its application. I think we're facing a threat of it becoming everything to everyone. And but on the positive side, I think there is some good progress. I think your discussion of pillars of social capital was really helpful. I think tying the definition of social capital and its meaning back to capital, what is capital and what is social, is helping to anchor the concept of social capital. So I think it's sort of going in both directions. In some ways, we keep getting new definitions of social capital. And then in other areas, we see efforts trying to, you know, ground it perhaps in the concepts of capital and social.
I think an example of where it's becoming too broad and too general is sometimes I hear people use it in conversation, and when they say the term social capital, I'm so unsure by what they mean that it doesn't feel like they're communicating anything of substance. And I feel like the need to ask them, well, what do you mean by social capital? And what does it mean in this particular context in which you're using it? And it would be better if they used a different term, or they didn't use the term social capital, at least when they're talking in those kind of general broad ways. Have you experienced similar kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. And I think which could be positive or negative is how social capital is entering into our everyday conversations. When you hear politicians and people from a lot of different professions and backgrounds using the term, you say, well, we've come a long ways, which may be a good thing. But on the other hand, the fact that if you stopped several people and said, exactly what do you mean, you wouldn't get the same answer is also disconcerting. But I think we can cheer for the fact that it is an increasingly recognized phrase, and no, we haven't really coalesced around a definition. My grandson was reporting to me that in his lecture in med school, the question was asked, what is social capital? So once it gets into the med school curriculum, I think it's become mainstream.
Yeah, and I had a friend in New Zealand who was studying medicine as well, and came to me and said one day and said, oh, we were learning about social capital at uni today. And so clearly it is entering popular language, it's going into different disciplines, it's being taught, people are learning about it. And perhaps where it is useful is when we're describing something in a general way. You know, if we think about other species of capital, when we're talking about physical capital, we use the term in a general way because we understand there's many different types of physical capital. But when we want to just describe all of it together in a broad way, we could use the term physical capital. And the same with natural capital or human capital. You know, when we're looking to make broad and general points about that nature of that particular type of capital, we can use the term. But when we're wanting to talk about something more specific, then we do. If we're wanting to refer to specific qualifications or degrees or expertise that somebody has, we're probably not going to use the term human capital. We're probably going to be talking more specifically. Same with physical capital, and the same with natural capital. If we're talking about ecosystem services, we'll talk about that. If we're talking about forestry and forest resources, we'll talk about that. But if we just want to talk generally about natural capital, then the term can be used and it can be quite effective in communication. So perhaps the same situation applies to social capital, where it's useful and relevant in a general sense, but when we get to specifics, actually we should be using more specific terms.
I think that's well said. In fact, often when I hear it discussed, it's describing a particular outcome involving people or groups. And you say, well, what contributed to that outcome? And the statement always appears or often appears, well, it was the social capital that existed in the relationship. In fact, if I were to sort of put a fence around the meaning of social capital as it's commonly used, I think the word I would use would be it refers to relationships. Not exactly sure exactly what it is, but in most of the common and most popular definition, it does appear that they are using it in connection with relationships. So whatever it is, it has to do with relationships. And if you're talking about relationships, then you're talking about how people are connected. And that leads you to, okay, exactly how are people connected emotionally, economically? Do they have things in common? And that then brings the discussion to a more specific, point. Exactly how are they connected?
But that then suggests that, of course, it is everything and it is everywhere, because if it is about relationships, then we have relationships in everything that we do, with our family, in our workplaces, in interest groups, sporting groups. Relationships exist just about everywhere, and so it does suggest that social capital kind of is everywhere. And someone once said to me, describing a network, they describe a social capital network. And I said to them, can a network not have social capital? Is there such a thing as a non-social capital network? And they didn't understand what I was talking about. But this is getting to that point of, if it's about relationships, then a network is about relationships. Therefore, social capital is involved in every network, in every relationship, whether it's positive or negative or only a little bit positive. But it does suggest that it's everywhere.
So the alternative to this very everywhere definition of social capital or approach to it is to ask, well, are you referring to only a particular kind of emotion or set of emotion, only positive emotions, or only relationships based on some kind of an inherited quality? Are you willing to limit the definition of social capital to a very specific kind of connection, or maybe a connection useful for a very narrow set of activities? And I haven't heard any discussion around how you would set limits to what kind of connection. But that's what the discussion is calling for.
And I guess when we do define it positively, only positively, and when we define it by its outcomes, we run into the possibility for all sorts of tautologies to exist, where it is something, but only when it produces a certain outcome. And if it doesn't produce that outcome, then the same thing is actually not social capital. It's something else, perhaps. And that clearly has some problems. And the critical literature on social capital has called that out consistently. But we, in terms of the people working on social capital, don't seem to have taken that criticism fully on board, because we don't seem to have adequately, I'm talking as a general sense in the literature, we don't seem to have adequately taken into account possibility that there can be positive and negative outcomes often simultaneously, and that it still is the phenomena that we're talking about. It is still social capital effectively regardless of what outcomes that it produces, and that continues to be a challenge, it seems.
It seems to me, if I look back over the recent progress, connecting social capital to capital and then expecting it to have the properties of capital has been a useful way to put a fence around the concept of social capital. It is a stock. It is a potential. It can produce something. It can be sustained. It can depreciate. Lots of the things that we associate with capital apply to social capital, and the fact that there is a flow that is produced by capital is also very helpful when it comes to describing what is social capital. So I find that to be one of the recent marks of progress in the discussion of social capital, taking seriously the fact that social capital is capital and it is social. It has to do with people and their relationships.
Yeah, so clearly there are some boundaries we can put on it. So if we ask the question, is it everywhere and everything, we can say, well, actually, no, it isn't, because it does relate to social relationships. And perhaps a useful way to think about this is that human capital, in a very general sense, is the ability to do things. You know, it's the ability for humans to labor, the skills, the knowledge, the experience that humans have that allows them to do things. But social capital is the ability to do things together. You know, it's the relationships that enable the collective or the cooperative or the social introductions or the actions that relate to each other. So when we think about it in that very general, broad kind of way, human capital being the ability to do and social capital the ability to do together, we are putting boundaries around it. We're saying, yes, it exists in virtually everything that we do as humans, because we do things together with or related to other people all the time. We live in society, in complex social structures, in families, and in relationships. So of course, it relates to all of those things that we do, but it isn't everything and everywhere. It relates to those things, and it perhaps helps to focus our attention on what it is in a broad sense.
So perhaps continuing this line of thought, when we talk about what social capital produces, we say, well, if it's capital, it must produce a good, something that satisfies a need. And so we say, all right, social capital has got to produce something that satisfies human needs. And then if we can talk about what the needs are, what the goods that are produced by social capital to satisfy those needs, we may even benefit further from connecting social capital to the idea of capital.
Yeah. And for people who are not economists, the idea of goods, of course, is something that is good. They can include relational goods. It can involve interactions on a social emotional level that produces positive outcomes. But is that consistent with the idea of goods?
Yes, I mean, a good is something that makes you better than you were before. So you could have physical goods that satisfy needs for food and shelter and warmth and so on. You can have relational goods that satisfy your need for internal and external validation, for belonging, for transcendent. We have lots of social emotional needs that we have some kind of agreement on. And so this may take us down the road of saying, well, what are the products of social capital? Do they satisfy physical needs? Do they satisfy social emotional needs? Do they help both? How do they do it? How do they do it in combination? I think those are all the kind of decisions that are the kind of questions that we can ask about social capital. And hopefully move forward as we answer those questions in a wide variety of settings. And
Yeah.
still, it's hard to think of a setting that doesn't connect people in relationships trying to solve the problem. So
Right. Yeah, and I think that's kind of the point of it being everywhere and everything is that relationships exist throughout our lives in every area of our life. And we could say that social capital exists only in certain areas, but only if we're saying it's only the positive aspects of relationships and the positive outcomes that it can produce. But we know that it can also produce negative outcomes or involve negative aspects, often at the same time. How many relationships are universally positive that we have? Quite often there's positive aspects and perhaps some not quite so positive aspects at the same time. And so this then does illustrate how it is everywhere in our life.
I think one thing that we might consider as we think about both the positive and the negative products of social capital is that relationships that we associate with social capital exist in some kind of social structure with other kinds of relationships. And once we go beyond just a dyadic relationship of two people, I think that allows us to see some more complicated outcomes that are both positive and negative. For example, you may have a very strongly connected network that you would describe as, well, they have social capital, but then there are persons not in that network, excluded from their benefits, that are disadvantaged by the social capital of a subgroup. And we often refer to that as sort of the downside of social capital, or the dark side of social capital are experienced by people excluded from or not able to join social capital networks. So I think as we go forward in our study of social capital, we need to look at more complicated social structures than simply dyadic combinations.
I would agree, and there is an assumption that all social relationships are positive, and I think part of that assumption is grounded on an oversimplified belief that if a relationship is negative, then the relationship doesn't exist. That you're not friends with people you don't like, effectively. That you would end the relationship and distance yourself from those individuals. But I think that view ignores what you're saying about social structures. That quite often we're tied into relationships that are negative as a result of the structures that we are part of. A simple example is it might be tied to your employment. If you work in a particular environment where there's some people who you really don't like and don't get along with and have negative relationships with, you still have relationships with them because it's tied to your employment. You could quit your job, sure, but your participation in that structure perpetuates the existence of those negative relationships. And a couple of years ago, I explored the limits of social capital and whether or not we could just continue to grow and increase and improve social capital. Can we just have more relationships and more trust and more empathy and more and more and more within any particular social grouping? Or is it in fact limited? And if it is limited, then what are the factors that limit this potential infinite increase in the amount of social capital or the strength of social capital in a social grouping? And I also looked the other way around, like what is the lower limit of social capital? Can things get worse and worse and worse? And at what point does, for example, relationships dissolve and you no longer have the relationship, so therefore you no longer have the negative outcomes associated with it? And the point you make about those social structures, those triads of relationships, highlights how you can have some really quite negative and damaging outcomes from relationships that do perpetuate because of the existence of those structures.
So you raised really an excellent question, Tristan. And I think I mentioned to you before that my relationship with my wife requires really steady investments in relational goods, that we spend time talking and visiting and so on. And that social capital is depreciable, and it requires energy to be maintained. and failure to do that, or to have an event that provides evidence of lack of trustworthiness or something, almost leads me to describe relationships, including whatever we're calling social capital, to entropy that, left on its own, relationships don't get stronger by themselves, they get weaker. And so we need to expend social energy as we try and maintain relationship. Now, as you just said, on the positive side, which I take great comfort from this, and it's what you said, that we have social needs that motivate us to make investments in relationship, to really work against entropy in relationships. And I find that to be a very encouraging idea.
And so certainly we could see then in some ways that there's forces that are pushing relationships towards more negative qualities and outcomes, but also forces pushing relationships towards more positive situations as well. And I think that is the beauty of what social capital is it allows us to consider the various reasons for these forces that push relationships in both directions simultaneously. And that's where the different disciplines of the social sciences have much to contribute to this, because psychology can contribute ideas, biology can contribute ideas, economics and sociology and all the different schools of thought within those disciplines as well potentially can contribute ideas as to what pushes these relationships in these different directions that ultimately then represents the capital. The social capital that we're talking about.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, that's all we've got time for in this episode. So thanks, Lyndon, for the discussion. Always fascinating as always. Look forward to the next one.
Pleasure to be with you, Kristen. Look forward to our next meeting.
Thanks, Lyndon.